You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This hour, why this evangelical Christian defies your simple labels. The phrase, speaking truth to power, is trending again in political circles. I've heard it in the Democratic debates. Someone said it recently about the outgoing intelligence chief. Half a dozen books carry that title. But Karen Swallow Pryor epitomizes it in the conservative Christian community. She's helped ignite Me Too within the Southern Baptist Convention. She's a never-Trumper at a college that welcomes Donald Trump. And she decries abortion even as she'd participated in an effort to create common ground between activists on both sides. She told a journalist recently, part of our polarization results from the inability of so many people to see that understanding is not the same as agreeing. As Karen Swallow Pryor joins us for the newest Women of Faith conversation, I'd like to hear from you. Do you have a tendency to see evangelical Christians one-dimensionally? Do you have a tendency to label them with certain tropes or stereotypes? And I'd also like to know whether you've struggled between your own religious beliefs and keeping an open mind to differing arguments. So taking your thoughts and your pulse on the idea of evangelical Christians, if you're within that community, do you feel like you feel the consequences of stereotypes about evangelical Christians? If you're outside the evangelical Christian community, I'd like to know whether you yourself have struggled between your religious beliefs and keeping an open mind to differing arguments about faith and issues. Here's a phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Karen Swallow Pryor is a professor of English at Liberty University. She's the author of many books, including On Reading Well, and co-author of the new book, Cultural Engagement. And she joins us today from Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. Karen, welcome, and I'm so glad you could be part of this series. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, you and I are kindred spirits when it comes to loving books and turning to literature to kind of figure out the world. And I was thinking this morning on my drive in that I'm seeking some kind of, I guess, comfort and answers for the kind of trauma that the country is going through right now with these shootings and the violence. And I have a tendency to turn to literature to find some of the answers. And I wonder if you do the same.
I do. And, you know, I think that many people who don't read avidly, or especially who don't read literary fiction, often think of books as an escape. And I'm seeing more and more that books are so much more than an escape. Reading literature changes the way that we think. It changes the way that we use language, the way that we understand other people's use of language, and everything we see on Twitter and in social media cultivates the exact opposite kind of thinking that books cultivate.
That is so true. There's so much moral righteousness in a lot of the information and the perspective that comes at us, isn't there? Especially if you're engaged in social media. And I think literature is the opposite of that. It gives you ambivalence. It tests your moral clarity. It's super valuable for that.
Exactly. And I talk a little bit in my book On Reading Well about some of the research that shows that we actually change the connections and structures of our brain based on what we read and how we read in even the medium, whether it's, you know, paper or screens. But even regardless of what form it's in, I just think being immersed in literary language is what we're losing, that kind of thinking, that kind of understanding of language. And so many of our debates right now are all about language and labels and hot takes. And it's changing the character of our nation and ourselves.
That's a good point. I wonder in a moment that is testing the resilience of of our fellow citizens, you know, as Americans, if there are practices that you turn to for some, again, some kind of clarity in the midst of all of the noise and the trauma that we're experiencing, what do you do in a moment like this?
Well, right now, I think I'm probably just as vulnerable as everyone else in terms of my being drawn to the things that addict us to social media. It's hard to fight. But I think what I bring to it is decades of this kind of thinking that comes from the exposure to multiple perspectives that we find in literature, the multiple perspectives that I have learned through my intentional activities in finding common ground and in dialoguing. And so that changes the way that I read a tweet or listen to a political speech. I've never exactly fit in anywhere where I am. And so my whole life has been a practice of trying to understand those that I disagree with. And fewer and fewer of us are doing that these days, I think.
Do you find yourself needing more contemplative time? Or do you feel the opposite, as in it's a moment when I must be as engaged as I can be?
I actually have to be very intentional about my contemplative time, because it's so easy to just keep reading the endless news feeds and streams on social media. And so, of course, my life is centered on books and teaching and writing. And so that's I'm fortunate that that's my job. And so I have to do that. But I do other things, too, as well. You know, I try to run and listen to books, and it's really about balance, because I do. Mm-hmm. If anyone follows me for 10 minutes on social media, they'll know I'm very, very engaged. But all of that needs to be balanced.
I noticed that. I followed you, too, as we prepared for the show. And I thought, how does she toggle between being engaged and you're not bringing just, as I think the phrase you used was hot takes. You are not just being glib, I notice, on social media, as we will find a tendency to do when you hang out on Twitter. You are trying to bring the same kind of thoughtfulness that I see in your writing, and I think we'll have in this conversation, to a platform that is not really known for that. It's an interesting ability that you're bringing to Twitter, some kind of, you know, deeper argument and higher thinking. How do you do it?
Well, part of that is my area of specialty in my academic subject. My specialty is 18th century British literature. Mm-hmm. And my knowledge and study of that era helps me to see a lot of parallels between what's going on now and what's going on then. They obviously didn't have Twitter then, but in the 17th and 18th century, there was, because of the emergence of print culture, there was suddenly a flood of pamphlets and sheets and essays and newspapers and cheap literature that swarmed the streets and coffee houses of England, and people who were newly literate were reading all of this, and there were so many political and religious wars waged on this newly cheap literature. And it was just as chaotic and polarizing then, I think, as it is now. And yet we saw great fruit come from the print age and from the rise of literacy. Yeah. So I want to redeem Twitter and social media much in the same way as some of my literary forebears did in the 18th century. I know that's a lofty goal, but at least it's something I can strive for.
I love that, because historical perspective is so important when you think it could never be, you know, it's never been this terrible. It's you know, let me take some calls here to Allison in St. Paul. Hey, Allison. Hi. So glad you called.
Thank you. So I grew up in a, you know, four squares, like Assemblies of God, very evangelical Christian community. Mm-hmm. And as I grew into my adolescence, I became more disenfranchised because I saw it as very exclusionary in the groups of people that I had or the conversations that I could have. And it was only as I started to read theologians like Greg Boyd, who was advocating for science is not contrary to the Bible, or feminist writers like Nadia Boltz-Weber or other theologians who are saying, you know, like females should have parity with men within the church, and that is how we were intended to be. Or Oshita Moore, who's writing about, you know, social justice and how Christians can be at the spear of social justice, and they have been, and showing how that history of Christianity, that I was able to come back to Christianity and to my roots and really be able to participate more fully within my faith in a way that's more inclusive and has Jesus at the center, but enters into dialogue and community with people who might have different views than I have. And so it's always heartbreaking to me when I see evangelical Christians just tied to such narrow-minded, bigoted views, because I do see communities within the Twin Cities that are not that, and that are reaching out and that are entering into dialogue and entering into community and being, parts of a diverse and an integrated community of multiple faiths. So I'm really excited about your guest today.
And, I'm glad.
And for Christianity to sort of like, people can see that it doesn't necessarily mean that, Trump.
You've given us a lot to think about, and I think Karen's actually the perfect guest to take this apart a little bit. What do you hear in Allison's experience, Karen?
Well, first I hear something that makes me want to say, welcome back, Allison. I'm so glad that you have returned to the community of faith. And even though we probably have a number of doctrinal and political differences, it is Jesus Christ that unites us. Because I sort of straddle these different worlds, kind of a challenge that I would want to make to Allison and others who are listening, who are frustrated by, my right-wing brethren and political and theological conservatives, is that we also need to be tolerant of them. I've been stretched and challenged the most in my faith as someone who fell in love with the life of the intellect and pursued a PhD, right out of college, and attended a very liberal university where I was the only Christian, and I experienced so much bigotry and intolerance. And it was very tempting for me to then become intolerant of my brothers and sisters in the church who did not pursue the life of the mind, who have limited understanding of the things that maybe I'm talking about and don't love literature or have very narrow political views. I have an obligation to be tolerant and loving toward them and to try to understand them, even as I was seeking and still seek to be understood.
Kim in Plymouth called. She said, I attended an evangelical seminary and I'm now mainline. I work really hard to stay connected to what evangelicals are saying, but it's hard. I don't always get respect for what I believe. It's also hard to be a listener rather than a speaker when you disagree. Karen, that's probably a skill that you've cultivated both as a professor, but also as somebody who is shaping opinions and speaking a little bit outside of the orthodoxy. How have you developed this skill that many of us must have of engaged and receptive listening?
That's an excellent question. And one answer is a very practical one. After spending a decade at the forefront of the abortion wars and the culture wars in the 90s, I did become involved, as you mentioned earlier in the introduction, in something called Common Ground, which was a dialogue, structured dialogues around the country between pro-life and pro-choice activists. And those dialogues actually provided very rigorous training in active listening and pursuing not compromise, not middle ground, but areas where people who wildly disagree can find agreement. So I've been trained in those skills. But after 30 years of teaching, what is teaching? I cannot teach effectively without hearing my students and trying to understand where they are coming from and where the gaps in their understanding and mine are. That's what effective teaching is all about, is knowing your audience, knowing what they're thinking, and then taking them, from where they are to learn what you hope for them to learn. And so a lot of people ask me how I can be so patient on Twitter and social media. And I say, well, I'm surrounded by wrong thinking people all day, every day. So, as we all think we are. So,
there was a time in your, that sounds like it was pretty important in your personal development when you were an anti-abortion activist and you actually went out and demonstrated in front of clinics. What I read of that time, though, is that you were also concerned about what the tactics, the personal demeanor of many of the people around you and the way they interacted with women who were making those decisions to go into these clinics and have an abortion. What comes out of that? Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that experience and now what you understand about that.
Yes. I mean, I was raised in a Christian home, but just didn't really embrace my faith until I was introduced, among other things, to the abortion cause, which I saw very much and still see today as an issue of social justice, not just social justice for the unborn children, but social justice for the women who are put in circumstances because of the structures of our society where they feel they have to choose between the life of their child and their own well-being. That is a matter of social justice. And so when I was out there protesting abortion, I was doing it on behalf of not only the unborn children, but the women who never really, really want to get an abortion, but are in a society where that seems to be the better choice. And so I would dialogue with the women going in, with the counter protesters. At the same time I was doing this, I was, you know, in my early 20s, in a PhD program, surrounded by people who not only thought very different from me, but were oftentimes counter protesters. So I was immersed in this space where I understood that in order to be effective, in order to be human, I had to listen and understand, even as clearly I held to strong convictions and still do.
So do you still find yourself out there in that activist role, maybe in front of clinics, still trying to intervene with women who are deciding to get this kind of reproductive care or not?
Well, I don't now. I actually live in an area where we don't have abortion clinics. I served for a number of years on the board of directors of our local crisis pregnancy center. And I feel like my role has shifted now that I am in the classroom every day and also have begun writing more. And so I do think that I'm still an activist. It's just taken a different form.
Okay. Call here from Kate in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to add to the conversation that I am a Catholic woman, cradle Catholic. I did leave the church and explore evangelical Christianity for a while, came back to Catholicism. But in my role as a Catholic woman and mother, and I have done crisis pregnancy counseling in the past, I find that there's a lot of misconceptions about Catholics and about the way that the moral compass and directives that the church sets for us as Catholics affects other people's perception of us. I feel that as a whole, many Catholics are not judgmental, that we're willing to offer compassionate understanding to people and meet them where they are and respect their different life choices and love them for who they are. But the conception about Catholics is that we're going to be very judgmental or unwelcoming, and that really has not been my experience, and that's not what I try to offer to others when I meet them. I really try to see their perspectives, understand where they're coming from, and explain why I've chosen my faith, not offer judgment.
Kate, do you think the gap in understanding comes between some of the pronouncements of the hierarchy, you know, what the leaders of the church pronounce about what Catholics will be doing and how it affects, you know, our cultural daily lives, and then how individuals like you live their faith and live in their communities and live in the world? I mean, is that where the gap is? And do you think that's where the misunderstanding happens?
I believe that the gap comes between taking the sound bites of the directives and living out the faith without understanding the complexities of where these directives are coming from and the history that has led the higher ups in the church to make these pronouncements to try to clarify the faith to the laity.
I see.
And I feel that Catholicism is something that you need to really take the time to study and understand and embrace as a whole faith, not just choose sound bites that are the most controversial and say, this is the church right now, but understand the whole history, where we are now and where we're moving in the future.
Karen, how's that sound to you?
I think what Kate is saying is so right. What she's talking about is one of the chief characteristics of our culture today, and that is that everything is so decontextualized. The sound bites, the image on the news, there's no context for it. And a lot of this is due to, you know, all public radio excluded, but to media, the media image. I don't just mean, you know, the news, but I mean all of the media, whether it's an image or a soundbite or Facebook, we get bits and pieces apart from context. And that's what context is provided by our actual relationships, knowing our neighbors, reading books rather than just quotes. All of that deepens our understanding of the things that just sort of rise to the top that without that context, we really don't understand.
As you've joined us this morning, you're hearing the latest in our summer-long series of Women of Faith. Karen Swallow Pryor is with us. She's a professor of English at Liberty University. She's the author of many books, including one that's on my shelf, On Reading Well. And she's joining us today from Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. We're having a conversation about, as I set up the show, I said, Karen defies, I think, a lot of your labels, those easy labels about Christianity and evangelicalism. But she also has a reputation for speaking truth to power, and we're teasing that out a little bit. As you join into the discussion, I want to know whether you've struggled between your religious beliefs and keeping an open mind to differing arguments, particularly, let's say, since we're talking about evangelical Christianity this morning, if you are within that community, but any faith, how have you handled the challenge of that? And if you are within the evangelical community, do you feel like you are the target of some pretty easy and simple tropes and stereotypes about what it means to be evangelical in America? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, anywhere here in the upper Midwest, and then on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Call here from Donna in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hey, Donna, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, Carrie, and hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I grew up in a very conservative evangelical Christian family, one in which expected me to attend either Bob Jones University or Pensacola Christian that you would be familiar with as being even more conservative than Liberty. One of the things I struggled with growing up was the inability to exercise critical thinking that was not encouraged. And as an academic now, as someone who is broken away from that and also gotten a PhD in the sciences, you know, I was finally able to put that into practice. But one of my resistances to attending a school like Liberty or somewhere else was the concern over not being able to be a critical thinker. So there's tolerance, as you described. My question is around critical thinking and the extent to which you're able to teach that and encourage that in your classroom, but maybe even more importantly, to your own administration. Do you have the academic freedom to construct a critical dialogue with your administration over topics like hiring of Ian McGraw, disgraced athletics director from Baylor, or other positions that they've stated? I'm really curious about how you handle that and balance that as an academic there, as a faculty member. Thanks.
Thank you, Donna.
Sure. Thank you. Critical thinking is the issue, really. I think for all of us, regardless of whether we are people of faith or not, that's the crisis in our culture right now. In terms of being here at Liberty University, we teach critical thinking. I teach English, probably the most critical thinkingest discipline of all, if I may say so. And I am surrounded by colleagues and administrators that are of like mind. Now, do I agree with the priorities and decisions of the upper administration entirely? Absolutely not. I don't know of any institution where that would be the case. And having spent so much time in a secular university, I mean, this is a question some of my students will sometimes ask is, because they're frustrated with something. Why do you stay here? And how can you disagree with this or that and still be here? And I said, well, because, you know, I feel like I had it a lot worse when I was in, you know, a state university. So I've seen and taught in other secular institutions. There are always these kinds of tensions that just the nature of the tensions change. And I, you know, here I am. I've been here 20 years. I'm talking on public radio about my political and theological beliefs. And I have the freedom to do that. And so I actually feel like I have more freedom than I did when I was a PhD student at a state university.
Karen, I guess I'm interested in how you've reconciled the embrace of Liberty University of President Trump and your own pretty strongly held views that he is not representative of the values of the evangelical faith. What do you do with that?
I think that's the question that's facing so many of us. I mean, and it's not just about Liberty University. It's not just about one person who is a supporter of Trump. This is the crisis of the faith that I think the church has been facing since 2016. Obviously, it didn't just happen overnight in 2016, but this has been a crisis of faith for all of us and on both sides. We really are seeing where our priorities are, where in whom and in what we are putting our trust. As someone who was involved in the culture wars of the 90s and you know the 80s, I understand the temptation to and the reality of putting your trust in the political process and in politicians. I understand that. I have come to change my views on that, but I still understand people who do. I still believe in the importance of the Supreme Court and their decisions and how they affect society. So I do understand people who vote along those principles. I just also that was the same movement that taught me that character counts. And so I believe that character counts and will vote for a third party candidate who has character over any two party candidate, main party candidate who doesn't. But these questions that I'm talking about, that I'm facing, are the ones that, especially within evangelicalism, that we all have to face. And I think is a test for each one of us. And I think the people who support Trump and the people like me who are never Trumpers are equally at risk of failing this important spiritual test, this crisis of faith.
Why do you say that?
Because as one of the first callers said, Christ is what unites us if we are a Christian. And if I cannot listen to and try to understand, even if I disagree with my brothers and sisters in Christ, then I am no better than they are. We are all right now influenced overly by fear. I think fear. I think fear is what is driving a lot of this. And we are a room full of afraid people, and we need to we're afraid of different things, but we need to listen to one another before we can comfort one another and face those fears.
You know, as I listened to you answer the call, though, Donna's questions, I thought, I wonder if you're acknowledging some of the writing that followed trying to figure out why evangelicals have been so supportive of a president who, to be honest, seems pretty spiritually empty. And whether you are validating this idea that came out that evangelicals really don't really care that much about whether he embraces the tenets of the faith. All they really care about, and let's just clear away a lot of the noise about religion, all they really care about is that he was promising to put conservative justices on the Supreme Court. It was about policy. It wasn't about faith. And if it's about policy, why not just say that? I hear you kind of validating that.
Well, I think a lot of them, I think most of them have said it's about policy. So, and that's where the disagreement is.
I mean, I'd have to go back and read the speeches of the president of Liberty University and others, Franklin Graham, some of the things that he said. But I think there was a real using faith for a cover of saying we're going to get what we want and we're going to clothe it in, you know, a bunch of language about faith.
Right. I mean, I think there have been has been some of that, but most of what I have heard, and that includes Jerry Falwell saying that, you know, we're not electing a pastor in chief or something like that. So I think he's been very clear that it's been about policy. Some others, I think, maybe have tried to, who are less comfortable with the president's character, have tried to justify it in spiritual terms.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Karen Swallow Pryor with us. She's a professor of English at Liberty University. She's the author of On Reading Well, and she's the latest in our Women of Faith conversation. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. I want to also ask Karen about her experience in signing on to a letter to the Southern Baptist Convention and really being active in the hashtag MeToo and hashtag Church2 movement. And of course, all of your calls and questions as well. Back to our conversation now with Karen Swallow Pryor from Liberty University and the author of a number of books, including On Reading Well. And I want to say this, that all of our Women of Faith conversations, and there are many now, are collected in one place. You can find them on one page at nprnews.org, and you can find them in one podcast stream. All of these discussions, lots of different views, lots of great questions from you, the listeners. So check that out. Okay, want to grab a call here from Pam in Montevideo for Karen. Hi, Pam. Hey, Pam, are you there?
I'm calling today because I'm a dissenter of the evangelicals. I mean, I'm a Christ follower. My dad is a Baptist minister, very conservative, who voted for Trump. We've had a lot of turmoil in our family only because I'm a never Trumper. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm a Christ follower, and getting back to this whole center of being Christ, one of the things that I'm finding out is that I want to be understanding of other people who differ from my opinion, but my conscience is set that I cannot follow someone who is bereft of any morality. And I feel that on many levels, Christ's teachings aren't being followed by the president, for sure. That's pretty obvious. But it pains me to see the rift in the evangelical church right now, because those of us who are never Trumpers are a very distinct minority. And so it's a balancing act. And having run for office before, it was difficult to run as a Christian and hold on to my beliefs, but I successfully did that. Even though I didn't win, I knew that that was always in constant tension. And so I'm feeling it. I'm on social media off and on quite a bit, and I've gotten to the point where the only thing that I feel that I can do is to try to be helpful to people who are hurting when I see that and intervene to them offline. And talk more on a one-on-one basis and try to keep my check of being love and light. And that's difficult because there are some really unsavory characters on social media who do not want to listen to their soul. And I'm concerned about the soul of America.
Pam, I know you had more to say. We have a lot of people that want to speak, but I think I have the essence of what you're saying here. Karen, what do you think?
I mean, I agree with Pam. I agree with the angst and the turmoil in her words and her voice. But again, I think that knowing history and thinking about the context helps. I mean, I come from people, and I mean, you know, evangelicals who were slaveholders before the evangelical movement. My people, the church, burned people at the stake. They, you know, persecuted people. There is so much sin and inhuman treatment of other human beings throughout our history, that it is just the human condition, and it is part, and Christians are not immune from it. And so I think we just have to understand, those of us who are, I guess, lucky enough to struggle with smaller, more private sins, still have to, you know, we still have to understand that we are not immune from them. I mean, my movement, she talked about people who lack a morality. I mean, I believe that abortion kills an innocent human life, and yet I am surrounded by people who have done that, because one in three women, between one in three and one in four women, will have had an abortion by the time she reaches the end of her childbearing years in America. That's the reality that I live with as well, and yet I love those people, and I want to understand them, and so we have all done so much that is wicked and sinful, that none of us is in a position to reject someone else's humanity based on their immorality.
So since we've brought sin into the conversation, I want to talk about this letter to the Southern Baptist Convention about Paige Patterson's behavior and his words about women. You went public with your condemnation, not just in signing the letter, mm-hmm. but also on social media. You didn't say, this is interesting, you didn't say, I'm going to sign the letter, but I'm going to, you know, I'm going to, I guess, be quiet about it or take what mm-hmm. I would say is the easy way to do it. I'm putting my signature on it, and now I've done enough. No, you were really forward-leaning on this, and you went out onto social media to I think, courageously call this out. What happened in the wake of that?
Well, what happened in the wake of that, and the reason I did that is because this is a pastor and a leader within my denomination, so I felt I had an added responsibility to clean my own house in that sense. I mean, this is my denomination. These are my people. And these behaviors were something that I had only recently become aware of. I was approached also by a victim of sexual abuse who could not go public, and it was really on her behalf that I helped to lead up this this letter and this campaign, because I have a voice that I can use on behalf of others. Mm-hmm. And eventually, well, what happened was the first decision the Board of Trustees made was to offer Patterson a pretty cushy retirement. And on that day, within hours of that decision being made, I was actually hit by a bus walking the street in Nashville.
This was in Nashville, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I spent 8 days in the hospital from very severe injuries and a very freak accident. And on the day that I was put in a medic van, strapped in on a gurney to head home to Virginia, while I was in the van, the word came out that the Board of Trustees had changed its decision and had, you know, released Patterson from his position and his retirement benefits entirely. And that is how it has stood since then.
I read some of the details of this accident that you had in your recovery, and I wondered about whether this is a reminder of the fragility of the human body, right, of course, mm-hmm. when something like this happens, but also mm-hmm. of how long our time will be here. And I wondered whether it gave you a sense of urgency about the work that remains to be done, or whether you came away from that with the sense of being, I don't know, more removed from the everyday angst and drama, and more balanced about, more philosophical, I guess, imbalance. What would you say?
Well, I think in a way it's both. To kind of bring another thread of our conversation back to this, you know, literary language, especially poetic language, is one that is language that is both, you know, concrete and symbolic. You know, it's right. Uses, you know, literal words in a transcendent way. And getting hit by that bus, not to over spiritualize or make it seem weird. I mean, I'm a good Baptist. I don't really get into all the spiritual warfare things heavily like my charismatic brothers and sisters might. But I have to say that it was such a bizarre experience that it made me think. It was really like a physical, literal experience of what the church had been doing spiritually to women for a long time. My body was broken under this machine and run over, or, you know, thrown up and landing with a great crash. And it was other women who said this to me, who saw this. And this was really a symbol, in a way, a kind of prophetic symbol of what was happening, what has been happening to women and to others within the church. And we have to change that. We see it. It's in front of us. And the time to change it is now. We have no excuse. I have no excuse.
How are you doing today, by the way?
I'm doing miraculously well. I am, you know, I suffer some intermittent pain now and then, but I'm back to full activities and in some ways I think stronger than I was before, just because of the intentionality of my physical therapy and exercise. And so I'm just so grateful. I will always have, I think, a reminder. I have a large pelvic screw holding me together, and I think it will always be a reminder of what happened and what we still have yet to do.
Nicole says on Twitter, "This show is so welcome today. I've felt like an island among my more conservative brothers and sisters within the evangelical community, though I'm not ultra progressive. I don't feel like I can talk openly at church. I've been tacitly rejected at a different church for speaking my truth." And Paul says, "As a former evangelical pastor, I know that there's a great many well-meaning, faithful evangelicals. I also believe there's a massive, powerful machine behind it all that's steeped in preserving straight white male power, who are using the well-meaning believers as pawns to advance that agenda." How does that strike you, Karen?
Probably about a year and a half ago, I would have said no. But today, I think I see that more.
Why?
And because I think that power is very seductive, and I think that there are people who fear losing power, and this is not true of most of the folks that I know. I mean, I've had a very good experience in the church, and that's why I think why perhaps it's taken me a long time to see it. But I think, you know, I mean, when we had recently within the Southern Baptist Convention, a group of old guard men make a video pointing to one of our heroes, Rachel Den Hollander, who has exposed sexual abuse in our nation and in our churches, and they aligned her with satanic power in this video. And these were well-respected men of the, who are
wow.
well connected. Yes, this is real, and these are powers and principalities that have root, and that I think that the veil is being stripped away, and God is being merciful in allowing us to see it and to correct it.
I hope she didn't retreat in the face of that. What did Rachel do?
Rachel is as strong and gracious as ever. She is a role model for us all, and the church is blessed, so blessed to have her.
Call here from Terry in St. Louis Park. Hey, Terry, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Yeah, thanks, Kier. I really appreciate this important discussion, as I've been struggling with issues in this area and dealing with some family members. And I've detected that there's a major difference between young evangelicals and older ones, especially with younger people being more open about areas related to science, climate change, social justice, race, GLBTQ, and even respect of other faiths like Islam. And I'm wondering if you feel that's true, and is there a chance that there will be a shift by older ones to seeing Jesus as a loving, accepting, and social justice committed being, rather than the Missouri Synod's focus on judgment in and the need to stop GLBTQ and other progressive ideas in order to not sin in the name of Jesus, a view that leads to harsh judgments, division, and deep fear, including belief that those who don't believe and accept Jesus will go to hell?
Karen?
Well, I love this question. It's so hard. So I think that the way of Jesus is the way of not either or, but both and. Again, I'm a lover of the word and words. And I think where conservatives have it right is having high regard and respect for the word as written in the authority of the word. And where liberals and progressives have it right is having a high regard for love. But the Bible talks about the truth in love, and it's not either or, it's both and. And this is the tension that both sides have utterly failed to hold in balance. And human history is a history of pendulum swings from one extreme to the other. And we would be just as wrong to go to swing to an extreme where we make that those words mean whatever we want them to mean or whatever we think them to mean, as the other extreme, which has, you know, sacrificed love for the authority of the word. This is the challenge before us. And I'm not young, but the young people around me and the younger evangelicals coming up have helped me to see things in a different way, while at the same time, the tradition that I come from, which holds a high regard for the authority of Scripture, is one that I will never let go. It's really about that hard work of living in the cross, in that tension where all those things are balanced.
So you like the hard questions. Here's another hard one from Joe on Twitter, who says, queer man here, please explain to me why I should be tolerant of the very wrong intolerance of others. We get this question in so many different ways in various conversations. It'll be interesting to hear what you say about it.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I'll go professorial on you and say, I think it's the wrong question. Tolerance doesn't mean a lot to me. I know I brought that up before, but I don't think tolerance is the prime value. I think love is. And of course, that begs the question, well, what is love? But I think that the Bible shows us what love is. It tells us what love is. It is patient and kind. It seeks right. It does not hold a record of wrongs. And we can disagree with people and yet still love them. I mean, that's what family is, right? If we use family as the model, families are the little school where we learn to disagree with one another and yet still love one another. And we can believe people are wrong. Again, I'm surrounded by young wrong people every day, and yet try to help them reach understanding, and that's so much more than tolerance.
Okay, I have a couple minutes left, and I have two book questions left for you. What's the best novel you've read this summer?
Oh, the best novel I've read this summer. I have not read many novels this summer because I've been researching writing. But if a rereading counts.
Of course, oh, yeah.
Okay, then it would be Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen.
Why?
It's one of her early works that often gets overlooked, and it's definitely rougher. It's less mature than her other works, but it actually. And this is why I'm rereading it and writing about it. It actually does what I just talked about. It shows us and models for us how we need to balance two competing ideas, such as sense, which is reason, and sensibility, which is feeling. I mean, Austen was way ahead of her time in understanding that true virtue consists of moderating our human tendency to go toward extremes. And that's basically what Sense and Sensibility shows us.
So how many times have you read Jane Eyre?
Oh, goodness. I teach it maybe every other year or so. So it's been, you know, I would say dozen times or more. It's my favorite novel.
I want to come audit that class. It's mine, too.
You are welcome.
Karen, thank you so much for a lively and interesting conversation. I'm so glad you were game to be part of the series. Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Swallow Pryor is a professor of English at Liberty University. Get the book on reading well. When we booked Karen, I didn't even realize I had this book on my shelf. I think there's a lot of insight there if you love books.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.